out of this house.
Hello, it's time for Raw Storytelling, a podcast where real people share unscripted and uncensored real stories, and I'm your host, Enid Nolasco. Welcome to Raw Storytelling. We're living really crazy times, but you know what? The great thing about raw storytelling is that we're only here to experience amazing stories that have changed people to their core. So imagine that the stories we'll hear today are in a few months from now, when we'll be, hopefully, fingers crossed, all okay. For now, we have three amazing stories from our April 2019 show, themed What the Fuck Just Happened. And what a show that was. Some of the stories you'll hear in this episode are intense and very important to share. This is one of those shows that was incredibly varied in how the storytellers approached the theme. So buckle up, this episode is great. And remember, these are not professional storytellers. These are everyday people like you and me. So dare to share your story. Reach me at rawstorytelling.org.
It attunes the psychic center of the human system.
First up is Sheva Gans. Sheva is an expressive art therapist whose practice is built around helping people navigate the challenges of divorce in creative and positive ways. And her story is titled The Hole in the Sheet.
The thing I remember most about that night was standing by the hotel window, staring out into the dark summer sky, the hotel towel wrapped snugly around my naked body, as tears slipped from my eyes and blood streamed down my legs. I was 22 years old, and I had just lost my virginity. The man who had taken my virginity was my husband. Although husband felt like a really strange word to use because we had been married for around 6 hours. Growing up, I had grown up in a strict Orthodox Jewish household, and my parents had done everything that they could to try and instill Jewish values into me and my siblings. One of the main Jewish values, for those of you who have not met a Jewish woman in Florida, is, so you have, is to grow up and meet a nice Jewish man and raise nice Jewish children. The way to get a nice Jewish man to marry you is to not sleep with him because, as my mother often told me, why buy the cow if you can get the milk for free? So to make sure that premarital sex didn't happen, no touching was allowed. And to make sure that touching didn't happen, no fraternizing was allowed. And to make sure that that didn't happen, boys and girls were kept as far apart from each other as possible. Except, I remember having a distinct awareness of the energy between boys and girls, even from a pretty young age. And my parents noticed this, and I think they were a little bit concerned. I have this memory, I think I was around 3 or 4 years old, and I went on vacation with my family. And my cousin was there, and she was my age, she was around 3. And she had this little doll, it was a blue doll, and she called it her boy baby. And I had just met this really cute 8-year-old, and I called him my boy baby. And I spent the entire vacation chasing my boy baby around the hotel. And my parents got really worried. So they spent the next 15 years trying to keep me away from boys. And the best way to do that is to make sure that I am dressed modestly, which meant my body had to be covered from my collarbone, covering my elbows down to below my knees. Except it didn't work. When I was in high school, I fell in love with a son of family friends. His name was Avi Shulman. And we dated for a little bit secretly. It was really innocent and sweet. We would meet secretly in coffee shops. The first and only time he touched me, he took my hand and my brain exploded. I went to school the next day and I got all my girlfriends and I was like, he held my hand. And they were like, oh my God. and we lost our shit. As an aside, the night of the incident of the hand-holding, he was wearing sweatpants because he had just come from playing hockey. And to this day, sweatpants are kind of an aphrodisiac for me. Just saying. Anyway, he calls me one day, and we make plans to go and meet at a cafe, a coffee shop, around 30 minutes from my house. Calls me on the landline. I just want to date this for you. So I hang up the landline, and I tell my father, I'm going out with some friends, and I get in the car, and I drive to the coffee shop. And I'm sitting in the coffee shop, and I'm waiting, and he's not there. He's running late. Or I don't know. I'm starting to get nervous and annoyed. And I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. And all of a sudden, I look up, and I look out through the coffee shop window, and I see my father storming through the parking lot. And I freak out, because my father is really, really scary, and he is really, really mad. And he bursts through the door, and he comes over, and he drags me outside, and he throws me the car, and we drive home, and he's like, who are you meeting here? And I'm like, I'm meeting Eve, which was my best friend. And he said, who are you meeting? And I said, I'm meeting Eve. And he asked me for the third time, which was clearly, it broke me, I don't know, the magic third time. And I said, I'm meeting Avi, which he already knew because he had been listening to my phone conversation and had followed me there. So my parents made us break up, which we did. And it's okay, because I rebelled. I got them back, and here's how. I unbuttoned my top button in my uniform shirt. Oh, yeah. It gets better. I rolled up my sleeves past my elbows, and I hitched up my uniform skirt to above my knees. Oh, shit is right. So people started to notice in the community, and I started to get a reputation of a girl who hangs out in coffee shops and talks to boys and reveals her collarbone and knees. My parents told me I was ruining my sister's chances of getting married. It might have been true. My principal told me that if I started collecting wood now, I would not have enough wood to burn the fires that would consume me in hell. I'm gonna let that sit in for a minute. With that support, I breezed through adolescence until I hit my early 20s when it was decided I was ready to get married. The process was pretty simple. A matchmaker called my parents and suggested an eligible boy. Here are the requirements. He should come from a respectable, preferably wealthy family. He should be good looking, smart, studies Torah, and adheres to the orthodox standards of dress and behavior. And because it was generally acknowledged that I was quite the rebel, he should play guitar. I remember the night that a matchmaker called my father and suggested the man who I actually eventually married. And my father hung up the phone and turned to me and said, "We found your husband." And not in a way that I was forced to marry him. I was never forced throughout this. But in a way that we found someone who not only plays guitar, he plays bass and piano and flute and he rides horses and he's religious. It was perfect. So we met and we hit it off. And we dated for a bit. And then after a while, he bought me a bracelet and my parents bought him a watch and we were engaged. And in general, I was really in awe of his ability to be religious and spiritual, but yet push and stretch the boundaries of the system, which is something that I had never dreamed or dared to do. And we really were determined to do the right thing, and the right thing meant not to touch. Because we were only supposed to touch for the first time after, when he took my hand after the Jewish wedding ceremony. But one day we were out hiking, and I got a splinter in my finger. And he took my hand 2 months too early. And I was like, hand holding? I'm pretty much a hand slut. And then things got out of control. But let me explain to you what out of control looked like. I need you to really picture this. That night, he was laying on the couch, and I laid on top of him. Except, we put pillows on top of him in between us so that it was sort of like touching, and we were definitely tricking God. But then my neck got tired from holding my head up so that it wouldn't touch his head. And then I let go and my face fell on top of his face, which turns out is kissing. And then for real, all hell broke loose. We could not keep our hands off of each other. We were making out everywhere. We were hiding under the beds. We were in closets. We were just anywhere that we can hide. And we had to keep it hidden because we were trying to keep up the image of good Jewish law-abiding lovers. One time he came to visit me and he stayed at a family friend and they went out for a little bit. So we locked ourselves in the room and we were making out until all of a sudden we hear the front door open and he jumps off of me and jumps out the window and pretends that he was out for a walk by himself while I was in the house by myself, as if that's a normal thing for engaged people to do. And then he comes back around and knocks on the front door and comes in, except he wasn't wearing shoes, and his shoes were at the front door where everyone can see them. In retrospect, it's pretty funny, but at the time, I was deeply, deeply mortified. And we continued this cycle of desire for each other and our inability to keep our hands off of each other, to guilt, to resolve, to be stronger. And we continued through desire, failure, guilt and resolve. And we kept up this cycle for a bit until it was finally the most anticipated night of my life, the night of my wedding. So we get married, and it was a great wedding. And we rush up, it's a side note. We rush up to the hotel room, and I'm so excited. And we had no preparation for this at all. And I had no idea what to expect. And it's so embarrassing. I was so embarrassed. Imagine your whole life, I was told how dirty and shameful and wrong sex was. And then all of a sudden, at the flip of a switch, it was not only allowed, it was celebrated. And that's a really hard mental and emotional switch to make in one night. And we get into bed, and I'm so embarrassed, and I get undressed in the bathroom, and I run under the covers. And he tries, and it doesn't really work. And he tries harder. But the thing is that according to the laws of Judaism, there are a lot of laws pertaining to sex, especially on a wedding night. And when there's blood, which there should be if she's a virgin, which she should be, the husband is actually no longer allowed to touch the wife. And he's actually not allowed to be on the same bed as her when she starts bleeding. So we get into bed and he climbs on top of me. Clearly there's only one position. And we manage to make it work. And then he comes, and when he finishes, he sees that there's blood. And he can no longer, according to the law, touch me. So he jumps off of me, he rolls off the bed, and he sits himself on the floor, and he turns on the TV, and he completely ignores me for the rest of the night. And I lay there in shock. This was not what I had imagined. This is not what I had dreamed about. What had just happened to me felt so isolating and so degrading, and it didn't feel at all pleasurable or connecting or loving. And I know that a lot of you out there might have similar stories of your first time, of losing your virginity, of how awkward it was, or shameful, or guilty, except that I had just married him, and I had committed myself to him forever. And I got up, and I wrapped myself in the towel, and I went to stand by the window to think about what the fuck had just happened, and to think about my life and my choices and my future. And I did not know how to ask for what I needed because I had never been taught that my needs were worth asking for. We didn't have the skills to communicate or to connect with each other, and now we didn't have touch to comfort each other or bridge the gap between us. And unfortunately, that never changed. The divide that grew enormously between us over the next 10 years began on that night. And the callousness with which he treated me when he completely disregarded me in such a time of vulnerability was not the last time he treated me that way. I didn't know that I can deserve something different. How could I have known that? We weren't allowed to touch for a week. And when we finally were allowed to touch one another and had sex for the second time, I got pregnant. That's a different story. 10 years and 3 children later, I stood by the window again, watching him move out. And this time, I knew exactly what the fuck had just happened. Thank you.
I thought I was supposed to be the last one. Oh, I am the last one, because you weren't first. Is that right? Oh, I'm third. Okay. Trying to keep. Hello. Really excited to be here. I just moved to Fort Lauderdale, so when I found out about this group, I was like, oh my God, this is just like my city, so I get to do these. And it's usually like just for me to step out of my comfort zone, because I'm very used to telling people what to do, and I just wanted to kind of just start putting myself in front of people and talk, I guess. But my story, it's full of a couple of what the fuck just happened moments. And I got to take it back to New York. So I graduated from film school about 7 years ago. And I had just produced this documentary called The Homeless of the Magic Kingdom, which talks about the homeless children of Orlando, Florida. And the film got picked up by MSNBC. And I just graduated film school. I'm excited. The Film Academy of New York takes me there for the screening, and I'm meeting all these people. I'm feeling extremely successful, which I still don't have a single dollar in my pocket, but I was feeling very popular. So I'm in New York, and the Embassy of Colombia calls me, and they're like, how can we help you? And I'm like, I need funds. I need people with money so I can continue to grow as an artist. So they're like, all right, we're going to take you into our embassy, and we're going to bring in people so you can pitch an idea. So I had just written this film for about a year, and I was looking for $1 million. So you got to remember, I made a documentary for zero money, and now I'm asking for $1 million because I'm like super popular. So yeah, it doesn't work out that way. But So I'm in this meeting, and there's all these people. I'm obviously Latino from Colombia, and there's all these Colombians there, but there's also people just from all over the world. Two people raised their hand, and they're like, oh my gosh, we love this idea. The story is great. There was a French guy and a Colombian guy. So I had a meeting with them separately the next day, and it was up to me to decide who was going to be my executive producer, who's going to be this investor for this great next film I'm going to do, right? So I chose the Colombian guy because I thought, well, I'm Colombian, he's Colombian, Latinos, he's going to understand me better, he's not going to want to take away any of my creative ideas. And I called him up, he's like, great, you got to come to the studio. And when I get there, he's like, all right, I'm going to fund your film, but you're going to have to work for me for 8 months for free, and then we'll work in your film. And I thought, well, I got to pay my dues somehow. So even though I had already paid my dues as an actor in LA for many years, here I'm like, okay, now I'm in front of, you know, now I'm behind scenes, so I gotta pay my dues that way. So I start working for the guy for about 6 months with the hope that I was gonna get the money to make my feature film in Spain, actually, with this guy's money. So I work, I made maybe about 15 commercials, one documentary, a lot of promos for the guy. Obviously, I didn't get any credit for all of that stuff. I was basically working and he was getting all the money and the credits. And then I show up at his studio right before the 7th month, getting excited about my film, and the sign is gone. I'm like, what is going on here? So I'm like, oh my God, did I come to the wrong place? You gotta remember, I was not making any money. I was working 13-hour days, and I still had to work somewhere else so I could survive. I was really struggling. So I show up, the sign is gone, and there's like an eviction note on the door. Turns out the guy filed for bankruptcy 9 months before that. So when he signed my contract, my project was included into the bankruptcy, which made my script attached to the whole legal deal, so I never was able to make that film. So I'm in New York, and I'm like, what the fuck do I do, right? I'm showing up, I'm like, shit, I thought I was this very successful guy now. What's going on? So I'm going into this meeting with these other people, and they're like, Fomor, you gotta go to Chicago. I'm like, Chicago? It was December, right? So I'm like, Chicago? Why Chicago? They're like, because all the Latinos that are very successful are in Chicago. I'm like, oh my God, I gotta go there. I'm like, I have to go to Chicago now, right? So I'm like, fuck, I don't have any money. First of all, how am I gonna make these? So I go into a Starbucks, a cafe, and now I open up my laptop and I'm like, all right, I gotta go to Chicago. I've manifested a lot of stuff in my life that has worked. So I'm like, all right, I gotta manifest. So I open my laptop, I'm like, my trip to Chicago. And I'm staring at this thing thinking, where do you start planning? First of all, it was freezing there. And I didn't know anybody in Chicago, but all the successful Latinos were there, so I had to go to Chicago. Funny enough, I'm typing there and this guy comes and he's like, hey, Fomor. I'm like, oh my God, hey. He's like, I just saw your film, the one about the homeless. I'm like, I can't talk about that film right now, man. I really can't. I'm really homeless. He's like, well, are you going to Chicago? I'm like, yeah. He's like, when? I'm like in 2 weeks. I'll be there like in 2 weeks, I think. The guy gives me his card. I didn't have a card. I give him my name, which I rarely do, with my number. And he left. He's like, all right, I hope to see you there. Let's exchange numbers. So I'm sitting there and a day goes by and I get this message from him, like this text message. He's like, hey, so when are you going to Chicago? And I'm like, oh my God, like relax, like in 2 weeks or something. I don't know. 30 minutes later, I kid you not, I had an email with tickets for an airplane with staying. The guy turned out to be a city official, and the city of Chicago invited me with that particular documentary to go into Chicago to screen it for some organization. So long story short, because I'm trying to get to my Miracle on Biscayne, I'm in Chicago. I'm in Chicago feeling like a king again because all these people are waiting for me. With the only exception that I don't have a script, right? Because my script is now part of this legal battle from these other guy, which I cannot mention because he's very well known, and one day I'm going to mention it, but I can't mention it on camera. One day. But I'm in Chicago, right? And I'm like, so I'm in Chicago and I get into these meetings and there's a lot of nonprofits and I'm meeting all these great, great people and I'm like, and they're like, what can we do? What do you got? And I'm like, well, I don't have a film. I don't have anything written. What do I do? They're like, well, you got to write up a short film. You got to do a short film and we'll fund it. So I'm like, all right, I called a friend who's a scriptwriter and we wrote this really cool short film. And I ended up funding the project with the request that I had to come to Miami to shoot the film. It's a 25-minute short film, so it wasn't like a 7-minute film or anything. It was a very difficult film to make. So I'm in Chicago, I'm coming to Miami, and here I am in Miami, super excited. I have this money to make this short film. I ended up casting 9 of the like very successful and popular Spanish television actors, and I was super, super excited. And a week prior to us getting to shoot this film, the government shutdown happened, and my funds went away. So now I'm in Miami. The only thing I have is my backpack, a camera, which is a red camera, which I had gotten from this person who told me you can use the camera, but he didn't know that I was just riding with this camera on my bike. If you guys know what a red camera looks like, you guys know how heavy it is. So I'm like, all right, I gotta do this somehow. Nothing's gonna stop us, right? So I start the short film, and you know, I'm cooking, I'm doing everything, I'm doing the catering, I'm doing the shooting, and none of these people like literally know this, right? Like they would get to set, they're like, oh my God. So like here I am making phone calls at night, trying to get, you know, people to donate stuff. I mean, it was a job. Things got worse and worse and worse. And finally one day I gave up. I gave up on the set. I think it was like a Friday. And I told them like, don't come. We're gonna cancel the shoot till next week, because I just couldn't keep up with pretending. You know, first of all, I was worried about my work. You know, how do you, you know, I was so tired. And then by the time I would get to do my job, I was exhausted. I just couldn't even think of the story. So I canceled the shoot, and I took on my bike. And as I'm going home, I get this call from the person where I'm staying. And they're like, you know, we really love you, but you can't stay here anymore. And I thought, fuck, what else can go wrong? I'm just trying to make a film here. So I get on my bike, and I'm on Biscayne Boulevard, and I am just riding my bike, and I've always had this very strong faith. You know, I've always been a very faithful person. So I'm like asking God or the universe or what, however you guys call it, I'm like, what am I doing wrong? Give me a sign. You know, I had built this career in theater in LA before I went into film school, and so I was like, you know, I was doing okay. Do I need to go back into that? Everything seems to be going wrong. This was my third year out there without making any money. Basically, everything was just going wrong. And I'm on Biscayne with that camera on my back. Like, I hadn't eaten literally for like maybe 2 days. I didn't have a place to sleep. And then that night, I'm like driving, just riding the bike, asking God for a miracle. I'm like, you know, what's the miracle? Like, show me a sign. Am I doing something wrong? Obviously, I waited, didn't hear from him at all. I'm on my way back somewhere because I didn't even know where I was going. I think I was going to go sleep at some bridge, which I did. But I'm on my way back, and my phone rings, and it's this lady, right? And she's like, hey, for more? I'm like, yes. She's like, you know your film about the homeless? I'm like, yes, I know my film about the homeless. I became the homeless. Talk about manifestation. it's very true. She says to me, well, we'd love to show it. We really want to show that film, so can you come on Saturday to screen it? My very first question was, do you pay? do I get to collect any money at all? She's like, no, but it'll be a great thing. You know, these people really know you and they love you and we just want to have your film. It was a church. I'm like, all right, I'll be there. Long story short, Sunday. And so I still have no strength in me to call people and say we're going to shoot Monday. I just kind of just forgot about the short film. I'm like, it's just not going to happen. Sunday, I wake up, and I'm like, right, I'm going to go do this thing. And I get there, and there's about 350 people. You know how I was asking God or the universe for a miracle and a sign? You know what these people did? I show up, and, you know, the film screens, and then at the Q&A, the lady calls me up, and I'm standing there. They ask me questions, and when we were done, she's like, you know that day when I called you? And I'm like, yeah. She's like, you know, something in my heart told me how amazing would it be for a filmmaker to get a note from people. So what they did was everybody that came through had to write something on a piece of paper. I asked God for one sign. He gave me 380 little notes that said, you're amazing, you've changed lives, keep doing what you're doing. I couldn't believe it. I'm literally like, I'm getting the notes and I'm like, what the fuck? Like it was crazy, like I just couldn't believe it. I ended up calling people back, I'm like, I'm making this thing, I don't care. And I told everybody, we have no food, we just gotta shoot, you know, bring your own food. I ended up making that film, and the last night, that Thursday night when I finished, I literally laid on the ground. It's about 8 o'clock at night. Yahoo.com had just named me one of the Latino filmmakers to look out for. And that night, Robin Cowie, the producer of the Blair Witch Project, called me as I'm finishing my short film, and I ended up working for him. So I was like, what the fuck was that? That was my story.
You just heard from Famor Botero. He's a Colombian filmmaker who has made amazing films, and we're so honored to have him on the show. To have somebody who took time out of their busy schedule come and share it raw means everything to me. So thank you, Famor, and you can find more about him in the show notes. Our last story for this episode is Amy Ballin. Amy is a survivor, author, and fierce advocate who can be found at raisingawarenessfortheinnocent.com or Raising Awareness for the Innocent on Facebook. Her book, Fabulous to Framed, can be purchased at Amazon or Barnes & Noble's.
How is everybody tonight? Good. All right. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Enid for the opportunity, Cafe Collective, and everybody who's shown up here tonight to hear this crazy story. That, by the way, Enid, was a tough story to follow, I have to say. So you know how you have these what the fuck moments? I had one before I got on stage. I thought it'd be really nice to wear a white shirt and then have some red wine. So this is my first what the fuck moment of tonight. It's a fashion statement. Everybody should try it once. It's kind of like painting and throwing things. Anyway, the subject I'm going to talk about is very, very serious. So I don't want anybody who's gone through it, experienced, has a family member, who's been, this is my disclaimer, by the way, that has gone through to think that I am taking this lightly. I am not. It's a very serious issue and something that I'm trying to make a difference in. So you're all saying, what is the issue? I'll tell you. So most of us are in our 20s, 30s, 40s, and at that age, we kind of know who we are, right? Would everybody agree we know who we are? We wake up in the morning, we go to work, we have kids, we know we've got to do gymnastics and this, that, and the other with our children, come home. Our lives are pretty predictable, almost boring, but safely predictable. My life was that way for 49 years, till it wasn't. I grew up in Brentwood, California, a place that nobody ever heard of until a little incident happened, which is my topic, in 1994 with O.J. Simpson and his wife. Now, domestic violence had never been a very in-the-front kind of conversation. In fact, domestic violence had been a very quiet thing. People hid behind it. It was the old, shh, don't tell. But when O.J. Simpson's incident happened, then laws changed. These laws changed, and I didn't pay any attention because, oh yeah, they weren't going to affect the girl from Brentwood. The girl who knew only the finest things, grew up in the best place to live, and then I moved to Florida. In 1994, when the incident happened, I listened, I paid attention, but I really didn't pay attention. I should have. In 1995, I started my fabulous life in real estate development. For 22 years, I was in real estate development, lived in Weston, raised two beautiful children, drove my big Mercedes, and my life was pretty predictable. Until one night in 2014, when with my second husband, we had decided to divorce. It was his last night in our home. And even though I knew I should not allow him in our home, I did. And I did it because I'm nice. Because I don't think bad things happen, because I watch true crime on TV. That's never going to happen to me. wrong. The night that he came home and he was moving into his new place the next night, he ended up attacking me. He had spyware on everything I owned. And when he went to the bathroom and I was texting, he said, "Who are you texting?" I was like, "Well, it's not your problem. You're leaving tomorrow." He came out of the bathroom, and have you ever heard about the people who turn black? Their eyes just turn black. I have never personally seen that because, again, I'm the little girl who lives in a bubble. I don't see stuff like that. I saw it that night. I should also add, he was a former cop, 6 feet tall, 225 pounds, and at the time, I was probably about 118, 5'4", without heels. That night, he attacked me. He took my phone, he grabbed it, he threw it against the bedside table. I dropped down and grabbed the phone, and the shard from the glass that he had broken slit my finger. When he got up off me, I thought, oh my God, he can never come back here again. I've got to get his keys. As I headed to the kitchen, he attacked me. He pinned me down to the floor. He put a knee in my back, a thumb in my neck, and held my head down. At which point, I'm sure I passed out. And when I came to, all I saw was this big guy taking my cell phone, threw it off the balcony, and I ran out the front door. Went downstairs in my pajamas and shoes, and anybody who knows me in this room, there's a few of you, I don't go downstairs in pajamas without makeup and shoes on. That's just not my forte. That day it was. I go downstairs, I call for help. I'm waiting for somebody to come rescue me. I was taught when you have something bad happen, you call the police. And aren't the police there to protect you? They are, aren't they? But in the background, as I was on the phone with the police, I hear this voice. "Should call the cops?" Concierge says yes. He says, "Good. Call an ambulance. She stabbed me with a knife." Wait a second, I got bruises all over me. Where's the knife come from? You hear me go from complete, this is surreal, to, oh my God, he's gonna say I did this. Well, that they're not gonna believe it. He's much taller. I have no record. I've never gone through, I do real estate. I don't do domestic violence. It's not me. Well, the cop showed up, he went outside, he met the first responder and told them he was an officer. The blue coat is very real. I sat inside patiently waiting, thinking that I was going to be rescued, and here were the people to protect me who I paid lots of taxes to. Only when they walked in the door, they asked me a question, and again, watching my true crime things, because I'm so fascinated by the unknown, things I've never experienced. They say, "Do you want to talk to a detective or would you like to talk to a lawyer?" It was a trick question of sorts because I didn't know when I said I wanted to talk to a lawyer at 10 o'clock at night that they were actually going to take me to jail. I thought I was going to get a lawyer at 10 o'clock at night. No, that's not the way this works. I went upstairs. The officer says to me, "You need to take your diamond bracelet off." I'm like, "Why?" "I like my diamond bracelet." "Because you're where you're going, you don't want to be wearing it." I go, "Where am I going?" "You're going to jail." "Wait a second, I have bruises all over me. I called for help. Can't somebody listen to the 911 call? He's an ex-cop." It didn't matter. He was an ex-cop. So the next 14 hours as I entered in jail, my beautiful pearl and rhinestone jeans that the cops handed me in case I didn't stand out enough. Again, fashion statements, that's what I'm all about here. So I get into the holding room and I'm in jail for 14 hours. And I get transferred to another jail from the intake. And the woman I'm cuffed to, literally we're cuffed, and she's an old woman, and she's got like no teeth, and she's drunk, and she's obviously been there before. We're walking, and she says, "Oh, damn, they didn't give me my medical attention." And I'm like, "What do you need medical attention for?" Look down, her hand has a cut, and she informs me she has hepatitis C. Welcome to going to jail. The next day I got out, and you know, you wake up one day and you're one person, and the next day it's like, what just happened? But to add insult to injury, the biggest thing that I can tell you and the hardest thing was I tried to keep it quiet. But when you have a mugshot out there and you have an ex-husband who's a little crazy and has tapped into all your stuff, he actually sent my mugshot to every person in real estate development, which, by the way, is a very catty business. If you're thinking about going into it, you better have thick skin. Maybe that's how I survived what I went through. And everybody knew, and I started getting text messages. Are you okay? Can I talk to you? What's going on? I'm like, what? I just got out of jail. I find out that my email has been sent to all 2,200 people in my business. And once that happens, you've lost control. So I hire my lawyer, I walk in his office, and I said, listen, I just want to know when he gets arrested and I get my voice heard. And by the way, no plea. My lawyer looks at me, he's like, are you crazy? What are you thinking? And I said, well, at the end of the day, I didn't do this. So even though I'm facing 15 years mandatory in prison, because my charge was one under manslaughter, I said, I will not take a plea. Even if it's for throwing trash out the window, I pay taxes, I will not go to jail. So for the next 16 months, I had started my own company. I decided, when my lawyer told me to be under the radar, I thought, you know what? I can either cry under my covers every day, or I can stand in front of this. And even though I don't know what the outcome's going to be, I know what my truth is. So my ex-husband, who thought that I'd be gone, unfortunately saw me for the next 16 months in magazines, on TV, on the radio, talking about real estate. I created a wonderful project in Pompano Beach called Sabia Beach. That was my project. Everybody said, you're not going to hit numbers. I broke records in that market while I was facing going to jail. I go to marketing. Thank you. I would go to a marketing meeting in the morning, and then I would go to a calendar call in the criminal courts. I'd walk in, and automatically they'd assume that I was the victim, which I was. So they'd say, you sit over here. And I said, well, that's where the victim sit. I'm a defendant. I'm over there. Talk about, I learned a lot. Let me just put it to you that way. And as my journey went on, I realized that I was changing as a person. I stood in front of this. I didn't let what happened to me define me. I was going to define what that story was. And the story wasn't what he said it was. And, you know, I have two children. I have wonderful friends. And I decided the best way to come ahead of this was to write a book. Fabulous Life to Framed. By the way, it's in the back over there. No, I'm just kidding. And it really was a cathartic thing for me to do. I created a website called Raising Awareness for the Innocent for people who have stories. I got very involved with different, economically different people than me. My whole world got opened up to something I never experienced before and never thought it would be part of my life. So I'm going to say to anybody out there, if you don't think it can happen to you, it can. And when it does, or if it does, don't say you want to talk to a lawyer. Go to the hospital. Talk to the people that are there that can say, oh, yeah, that stab? No, he inflicted that stab on himself. My end story here was 16 months after I stood in front of the judge. I had voluntarily taken a polygraph, which is unheard of. But all I had was my truth, and I was not going to let it go. And when it came time to stand in front of the judge, the courts, the state, had asked for my polygraph. And my truth exceeded the threshold of honesty. So what do after I get out? I go to the state attorney, walking in there, like, I'm going to get my justice here. Because what the hell just happened? My whole life has changed. And I walk into the state attorney's office. He said, who's your lawyer? My lawyer represents the cops and he's really politically active. I thought it was good at the time, but whatever. And he says, you need to go tell your lawyer you came here. So I walk into my lawyer's office, who, as I said, deals with the cops, former cop. He's like, Amy, what are you doing? I said, well, I went to the state. I told them they have to arrest Mike. He beat me up. They agreed that I didn't do it. There's two of us. I didn't do it. And he looks at me, kind of tilts his head like I'm crazy, and says, you do know that I'm on the board to reelect Michael Satz for state attorney. And that's when I realized they all played it together in the sandbox. So what I'm doing now is trying to create awareness. I have a page called Raising Awareness for the Innocent with 150,000 followers on Facebook. I've done a lot of speaking. I've won a lot of awards. But the most compelling thing for me is you never know what's going to happen. And it changes and strips you down of everything that you are. And it's what you do to decide how you're going to manage that challenge to create who you really are. There you have it.
Thank you.
That's it for this month's show. Come back next month for more real stories by real people. Follow our story at Raw Storytelling on Instagram and Facebook or rawstorytelling.org. And remember to rate, review, and tell a friend about Raw Storytelling. Every little bit helps. Until next time, thank you to DJ Sandoz, who recorded the live audio for this episode's stories. Fabiola Lozada is our podcast editor and Cafe Collective is our host venue. The music you heard in this episode is by Set Tech and other varied artists featured on our live show recordings. I'm Enid Nolasco. Stay raw and wash your filthy hands.